NATO members signed the accession protocols for Finland and Sweden, paving the way for them to join the military alliance.
This is a good day for Finland and Sweden, and a good day for NATO. With 32 nations around the table, we will be even stronger.
Plus, Ukraine says it has struck a Russian military base, resulting in hundreds of deaths.
Ukrainian officials confirmed that more than 200 Russian servicemen were killed and more than 300 were wounded.
And later in the program, how one nonprofit is working with Ukrainian children to share their art with the world. Today is Tuesday, July 5th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. NATO members on Tuesday signed the accession protocols for both Finland and Sweden, paving the way for them to join the military alliance. Speaking in Belgium, Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, marked the occasion.
This marks the start of the ratification process. NATO's door remains open to European democracies who are ready to and willing to contribute to our shared security. This is a good day for Finland and Sweden, and a good day for NATO. With 32 nations around the table, we will be even stronger, and our people will be even safer, as we face the biggest security crisis in decades.
VOA's Henry Ridgewell is following the story and joins us from London. Henry, so what's next?
Well, this process has been going at record speed compared to other NATO applications in the past, and it was given added momentum last week just before the NATO summit when Turkey removed its objections to Sweden and Finland's applications. What we've seen today is NATO ambassadors from each of the 30 member states plus the foreign ministers of Sweden and Finland signing those protocols. So the formalities within NATO, if you like, in Brussels are done. Now the process must go back to the individual legislatures, the parliaments of each of those 30 member states for approval. And now most of the member states are fully supportive of Sweden and Finland's applications, and those could go through quite quickly. So we are talking really a matter of several weeks at the minimum, even for friendly countries, if you like, to get those approvals done. Now, the sticking point for Finland and Sweden could be over the conditions that Turkey has put on it removing its objections to their NATO membership.
Speaking of which, you know, that had been a point of contention. And then, you know, right before the Madrid summit, there was an announcement that the three countries had reached a deal. So what do we know more about what was, you know, agreed to in order for Turkey to alleviate its objection to both Finland and Sweden joining NATO?
Well, both Sweden and Finland have long been sanctuaries, really, for Turkish citizens seeking asylum, seeking to escape what they claim is political persecution back home. Now, that hasn't been a problem until now. Turkey, of course, is a NATO member. It accuses both Finland and Sweden of harboring what it sees as terrorists. Now, these generally belong to two groups. Some of them Turkey sees as Kurdish terrorists belonging to a group called the PKK, which is also seen by Europe and the United States as a terrorist group as well. Now, the number of people that Turkey wants extradited back to Turkey in return for moving its objections is around 70. Most of those are alleged to belong to the PKK. There is another group who Turkey sees as terrorists as well, who it claims are supporters of Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish national in exile, who Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan believes was behind the failed coup in Turkey in 2016. Sweden and Finland said they would look at those extradition requests in return for Turkey removing its objections. But they've made clear that any extradition proceedings are subject to court and decision by judges, and it's not a political decision. So any of these hearings would have to go through the courts in Sweden and Finland, and there are several obstacles in the way of any of those extraditions.
VOA's Henry Ridgewell reporting from London. Henry, thank you. As previously noted on this program, after weeks of intense fighting in eastern Ukraine's Luhansk region, the Ukrainian military was forced to withdraw from the city of Lysychansk. While some analysts thought that the recent Russian gains may usher in an operational pause as Moscow prepares for its efforts to secure the rest of the Donbas, Russian artillery struck more cities on Tuesday. Reporter Anna Chernikova shared the details with me not long ago.
The most recent missile attack happened in Slovyansk, and Slovyansk is, for the moment, one of the main towns in Donetsk region. So we expect the increase of the attacks in Donetsk region, and Slovyansk and Kramatorsk would probably be two main targets. So today, it was a massive shelling of the city, in particularly the city center and north part of the town. The local market was hit. For the moment, we have confirmed information from the local authorities about one person killed. We don't, of course, have the final numbers for the moment, so details might come a bit later. But the local authorities urged residents to stay in shelters, and also for the past couple of days and also today, local authorities urged people to actually evacuate as soon as possible and while it is possible, because it could actually be the same situation as in Lysychansk, when a lot of people didn't evacuate in time, and then they were suffering, you know, the shellings.
And I also understand that Ukrainian forces say that they've carried out strikes on a Russian military base. What's being reported by the Ukrainian officials?
Yeah, we have confirmation from Ukrainian military, so we cannot confirm this ourselves for the moment, but according to Ukrainian military, as a result of an attack by Ukrainian armed forces, the airfield in Melitopol was hit by Ukrainian missile. And this military base was located in the occupied city of Melitopol for quite a long time now. Ukrainian officials confirmed that more than 200 Russian servicemen were killed and more than 300 were wounded. And for the moment, they say that Russian forces have left the airfield and the fire is still going on. This information comes right after the report by the Institute of Study for Study of War, which says that Ukrainian partisan activity is targeting Russian railway lines around Melitopol and Tokmak, which is the same area. And Ukrainian forces are increasingly targeting Russian military infrastructure with indirect fire and with HIMARS systems provided by the U.S. partners, basically using them deep in occupied territories. But again, you know, situation in Melitopol and situation in Kherson region is actually very, you know, is changing a bit, and a lot of partisan activity is reported.
Anna Chernikova is reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much for your report today.
Thank you, Steve.
Since the start of the war, many well-known Ukrainians have joined their lesser-known comrades to protect their land against Russian aggression. VOA's Russian service spoke with film director Alyssa Kovalenko about her work and her fight for Ukraine.
When the war started, well-known Ukrainian director Alyssa Kovalenko was heading to Donbas to finish filming her latest piece, Expedition 49.
The film is about children who live on the front lines and desperately want to travel, but simply can't.
The war forced Kovalenko to postpone filming, so in April she joined the armed forces of Ukraine with some help from a high-ranking acquaintance in the military.
He thought I'd be filming something, and I said, actually, I didn't come here to film. I came here to fight a war.
Kovalenko knew that she was getting into. She took a trip to eastern Ukraine in 2014, which resulted in the documentary Alyssa in Warland. During filming, the young woman was kept prisoner for 5 days by pro-Russian separatists. That terrifying time made her current decision to fight a lot easier.
Back then, I promised myself that if there ever was a war in Ukraine, I wouldn't look at it only through my camera. I would fight.
Kovalenko recalls that while she was filming the awards-nominated documentary, she not only perfected her directing skills, but also learned how to handle weapons. She learned all the other fighting skills in the past 2 months.
You learn a lot on the front lines. Many guys who have served for 3 years or more come there, and you see fear in their eyes. They feel lost.
Kovalenko is serving in the Kharkiv region. Her 5-year-old son, Theo, is in France with his father, French journalist Stéphane Sion, and Alice's mother.
It was hard for Stéphane, but he knows me too well. He knows that if I have made up my mind, I'd get what I want. It was difficult for my mom, too.
Kovalenko has decided to talk to her son about the war as sincerely as possible, trying not to sugarcoat her day-to-day activities.
I record a small blog about the war for Theo. I tell him what's happening. I always call whenever there is an opportunity.
Kovalenko says she's not thinking about cinema or making documentaries much these days. She just dreams about peace in Ukraine when her family, like millions of others, will be able to come home and feel safe.
That report was produced by VOA's Russian service. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Russia recently defaulted on its debt, the first time in more than 100 years. And while Moscow is still within the 30-day grace period following the missed deadline, the Kremlin has been downplaying its significance. Polygraph.info explains why their claims are misleading.
On June 27th, Russia defaulted on its international debts for the first time in over a century. The Kremlin has tried to dismiss the damaging consequences of default, along with shortages and inflation hitting ordinary Russians because of its war on Ukraine. Olga Kovitidi, a Russian senator from occupied Crimea, said, "Russia's reputation is improving, confirmed by the ability of Russians to fulfill their obligations in any extreme circumstances. That is misleading. In fact, Russia's default is a symptom of its isolation under harsh Western sanctions. Already, more than 1,000 foreign companies have fled Russia. Shell Oil pulled out despite a loss of $5 billion to the company. The default on 2 euro bonds came because sanctions stopped Russia from paying interest in euros and dollars. Analysts say the default could trigger forced repayments on billions in other Russian debts. Creditors could also seize Russia's foreign assets. To be sure, high energy prices sparked by the war help Russia's treasury. But Russia's central bank had to prop up its currency, the ruble, by doubling interest rates. Until the February invasion, the ruble was among the easily exchangeable currencies worldwide. That is no longer true. Now, the ruble is more like its Soviet-era incarnation."
Polygraph.info is a fact-checking website that's produced by the Voice of America. The website serves as a resource for verifying the increasing volume of disinformation and misinformation that's being distributed and shared globally. Now, to counter the threat of violent extremism, the U.S. State Department recently sanctioned 3 more people linked to the terrorist group Russian Imperial Movement, or RIM. Analysts say RIM is among several ultra-nationalist and white supremacist groups used by the Kremlin to sow division in the United States and Europe, even as it falsely claims to be fighting Nazis in Ukraine. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias investigates.
Paramilitary training, as seen in this propaganda video, is what the Russian Imperial Movement offers to white supremacists and neo-Nazis, according to the U.S. State Department, which in June sanctioned 3 more men linked to the Russia-based terrorist group. Heidi Bayrek is the co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism.
They have sort of an interesting relationship with the Russian government in that at times their symbols and some of their propaganda have been banned. And yet at the same time, they're allowed to function. They're allowed to bring like-minded neo-Nazis from other parts of the world.
As long as they don't dare destabilize President Vladimir Putin's rule inside Russia, radical groups serve the Kremlin's interests, analysts say, by sowing discord and inciting racial and ethnic unrest in Western democracies.
There's a lot of training of terrorism manuals. Lately is this idea of the Great Replacement. This is what motivated the Buffalo, New York shooter. This idea that white people are being intentionally replaced with people of color in various nations.
When neo-Nazis and white supremacists can't come together in person, they interact using internet platforms that aren't always moderated. And Moscow, according to researchers, amplifies their voices. Olga Lautman is with the Center for European Policy Analysis.
With the use of internet, they can take their message and spread it to billions of people via bots and trolls. Russia is extremely involved in creating media outlets that will kind of reaffirm and push these exact, disinformation talking points.
In this context, President Putin's widely disputed claim that Russia invaded Ukraine to denazify its neighbor is seen as disinformation. Alexander Verkhovsky is the director of the Zova Center for Information and Analysis.
To refer to Ukrainian self-identification, political self-identification, as just nationalist would be weak. This rhetoric is addressed to Russian citizens because in Russia, after the Second World War, the word Nazism is extremely negative. So if you blame your opponents or your enemies, this word, it may explain why you may or must take radical measures.
The Azov regiment that has repelled Russia's forces since 2014 is often cited by Russia as a neo-Nazi force. But rights groups and Ukrainian officials say that reputation is outdated and manipulated for Kremlin propaganda. Callum Farley is with the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism.
There have been a lot of efforts to kind of reform the movement and to push out any individuals who do hold on to these kind of far-right beliefs.
Instead, the eyes should be on Russia's own cozy relationship with white supremacism, according to expert Heidi Byrick.
Neo-Nazism, various kinds of white supremacy, are the number one domestic terrorism threat in the United States and multiple other countries. If the Putin regime were down the road to provide money and material to white supremacists, we will see more attacks and more effective attacks.
We sent repeated requests to Russian authorities for comment, but never heard back. Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
Leleka is the name of a Ukrainian bird and is also the name of a British nonprofit that is working with children in and from Ukraine to share their artwork online. Alexandra Lomachenka is the co-founder and chief executive of the charitable organization. And I recently spoke with her and began our conversation by asking how she got involved with Leleka.
So Leleka is a website where kids from Ukraine sell digital versions of their artworks. And these artworks, they can be drawings or watercolors or acrylic or oil paintings or digital artworks from the beginning. And anyone can buy these artworks for £7, around $9, and payment minus the tax and bank fees is sent to the young artist's family bank account. And Leleka is a non-profit UK-based company fully run by volunteers. We don't take any commission and not planning to do it in future. We just want to help kids from Ukraine to feel useful, supported, and in control again.
But if the fee structure is, aside from the banking fees and taxes, etc., everything is being sent to the children whose artwork you're selling or being the broker for, how are you staying afloat if you're not taking in any money? I mean, I know you're a nonprofit, but how do you stay afloat?
We are actually, all of us are volunteers, and all of us, we have full-time jobs. And I am a permanent employee at one of the British companies, and we invest our own money into Lilleca, and we invested around £10,000 already to cover the legal infrastructure fees, to pay for third-party tools such as Airtable and SendGrid. And it is very important, like, nevertheless, like, we are spending money, we are not earning money. It's very important for us to do that, mostly because I personally and my peer founders, we are Belarusians.
And of course, in 2020, there was a widely criticized election where President Lukashenko retained power. It's an election that many consider to be not free and fair, and resulted in mass demonstrations, mass incarcerations, and people leaving the country. So my question to you is, given that history, how did you personally become involved?
We've been working together. I have quite a big network in people working in technology, in marketing, in public relations. And these are people with really big hearts who are willing to support the Ukrainians and Ukrainian children specifically. And we just came together. We thought that it is a good idea, because children right now, like, what we believe in and why, you know, we've gathered this group of people, we believe that children are the most vulnerable group right now in the UK, in Ukraine. Adults can volunteer, adults can donate money, adults can actively support their country. They can heal their wounds with action, so to say, but children cannot. And so we built Lilleca together to be able to provide them with this opportunity to join adults who volunteer and who express their feelings through action.
How did you, you know, create this network of child artists? Because it's my understanding that a fair number of them are in Ukraine, and I'm assuming that there are also some who are among the displaced population after the latest invasion by Russia into the Ukrainian territories. So how do you make those connections between your organization and these amazing child artists?
Well, this is an incredible question. And yes, like, we have kids from all over. We have kids who are currently in Ukraine just right now. We have kids from Kharkiv and Bucha and Kyiv and Lviv and Sumy. And we have also kids who were forced to flee. And possibly, like, the answer to this question is the platform, the idea of Lilleca, it resonated with kids and their families majorly. So basically what happened is we did a slight push to communities, and people are forming Telegram channels, for example, and we did a slight push, and right now the platform is spreading organically through just word of mouth, and people are telling us how timely this product was, because it allows their kids to feel useful and to earn some money, which is a great help. At the moment, we have more than 2,000 children on the platform, and it's raising every time. So we would like to raise, at least to help children earn, at least £100 each, which means 200,000 is our short-term goal. But of course, we would like to spread Lilleca and allow children to earn as much as possible.
Alexandra Lemachenka is the chief executive as well as the co-founder of Lilleca. And you can find examples of the children's artwork at lilleca.me. Alexandra, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage on Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. And speaking of which, I'm heading out on vacation, so my colleagues will be sitting in the anchor chair for the next week and a half. So until then, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.